Live from the WTAD studios in the Lincoln Douglas building in downtown Quincy, it's time to pull up a chair and assemble today's WTAD News Roundtable.
It's Wednesday, I think.
Yes.
We can all hope.
You know, sometimes the calendar's hard. Plenty to talk about on the Wednesday edition of the News Roundtable. Thanks for being here. Jim Dewey, Newsmaster Jim, joins us in the studio.
Greetings.
Thanks for being here. Sure. Something. What happened at the Hannibal City Council last night?
Almost nothing.
Well, but no, but I know that that's not true. But something happened as far as businesses and places being tagged, right?
Yeah. What happened was, earlier this year, a local resident came to the council and suggested that they create an ordinance dealing with graffiti specifically. I mean, there are vandalism ordinances and so forth. Mm-hmm. He had he was born and raised in, I think it's Long Beach, California.
Okay.
And he brought their anti-graffiti ordinance, shared it with the council, and then the city attorney basically crafted Hannibal's ordinance based on that Long Beach ordinance. Now, last night, right before they voted on it, gave it a first reading, city manager Jeff Lagarce explained that there were some things in Long Beach that don't necessarily translate in Hannibal. For instance, in Long Beach, apparently, if you're under 18 and you have a can of spray paint, you can be arrested, or the police can take it away from you.
So there's possession. Essentially, it's possession.
It's illegal. If they had left it alone, it would have been illegal to sell spray paint to a kid, and it would have been illegal for a kid to possess it. And that just isn't practical,
right?
When you consider a lot of kids have jobs where they mm-hmm. required to maybe spray paint.
Mm-hmm.
What was left in is the ruling that if you want, it's against the law now, or will be when this gets second reading, to possess spray paint in any of Hannibal's parks.
For anybody.
And that was where the controversy came up. And it wasn't real difficult controversy. It was just a matter of interpreting. I didn't say
that. We understand what you mean.
Thank you. Interpreting the ordinance. The question was, what if, say, the Arts Council wants to have an Arts in the Park
mm-hmm.
event wherein they're giving kids cans of spray paint?
Sure.
And the city manager said they couldn't. But then it was discussed, and the way the ordinance is written, they could, but the city manager would have to give them permission.
Okay,
designee. So most likely, if the Arts Council is going to rent the park, they would go through the Parks Department, so Parks Director Andy Dorian would probably be the one giving them permission.
Okay, so a whole lot more government flavor. Because of, and how bad is graffiti tagging in Hannibal right now?
It's not huge, but it's bad enough. I mean, we had a guy, and I think they caught him, and he wouldn't have fallen under this, because he was like in his 20s.
Sure.
But he was going around tagging some kind of devil worship or, you know, Satan or something on light poles and stop signs. And
so we needed it. We need something different to prosecute.
Well,
something
different. Give police a little more authority to stop it. To give the people who own the city buildings and the city, or well, the city of course owns city buildings, but and even private residents, because a lot of the tagging that was happening to private residents.
Ah, okay. All right, so, but that was just the first reading last night?
It was the first reading last night. It'll get second reading at the next council meeting, and who knows, there may be another amendment just to clean up the language so that there's no question that, yes, the Arts Council or some other organization might be able to have an event and make it a little easier.
Special permission to have spray paint. All right. Thank you for the update.
Sure.
Jim Dewey from the Hannibal Bureau joining us in the studios this morning at WTAD. Scott Hardy, the Loveless trial continues again. Yesterday's, I would call it session, ended in an odd way. We were discussing it at the kind of the close of business here at Radiotopia yesterday. Kind of clue everybody in as to what happened, because it kind of rolls over into today.
Yeah, what actually happened was near the end of the day session, the defense brought out a stipulation that had been agreed to by all parties, the prosecution and Gibson, saying that in that stipulation, basically it said that Quincy Police and Gibson didn't turn over documents and emails to the defense during discovery, and Gibson admitted that that was an oversight on his part to do so. And in that part of that stipulation was, is that a special prosecutor Ed Parkinson said that some of the emails with between Gibson and pathologist Dr. Scott Denton of Bloomington weren't even turned over to him as well. So that's what the stipulation was. And that was reread this morning by Judge Bob Hardwick as well. Now, they've been going over, Gibson remains on the stand, at least through the morning, up until broadcast time, and basically it's been...
He's being cross-examined.
Yeah, both sides.
Okay.
He was cross-examined by the defense, and basically said he was... John Lovey accused Loveless, this according to KHQA-TV's Jenny Driesler, pursuing Loveless, even though what they phrased it was the mechanism of how she died changed, with originally thought it might have been poison, but then it changed to suffocation.
Mm-hmm.
And also mentioned that Gibson told the grand jury that Corey's body was in full rigor mortis when Cruz arrived. And then, of course, that's been a lot of speculation and
yes.
testimony about that as well. They've been getting into quote, smoking gun emails that John Lovey mentioned in his opening statement.
Smoking gun emails.
Yes, and those were the ones between Denton and Gibson, which where Denton said that the investigation was dead in the water if Dr. Jessica Bowman, who did the original autopsy, didn't change the cause of death from undetermined to suffocation. And the prosecution has been playing that down.
Okay.
They've said, is that a smoking gun? Well, they've said, no, not really.
So, and you mentioned before the show started that there was an interesting addition to the jury pool?
Not so much to the jury pool, but to the...
The witness pool.
Yes. In fact, she has been called, and then that she is Christine Loveless. Kurt's current wife has been called, and she is on the stand right now.
Okay, so Gibson's finished, and
yes.
Christine is now...
Yes, she is on the stand as
okay.
a prosecution witness as well.
And, of course, my question at the time was, well, she's like the newest piece to all of this. They've been married... They weren't married a whole lot
they got
in
married-
front of... Him being arrested.
Right. They got married earlier in 2014, just a matter of months before he was arrested in August, after the grand jury indictment.
Okay. Just interesting as to, you know, what she's bringing to the table as far as the story and the timeline that they're trying to piece together right now.
I believe it relates to the testimony earlier given, in fact, by Kurt's second wife, Erica Gomez, is what I'm getting at right now.
Okay.
So.
Okay. All right. Updates throughout the day?
Mm-hmm. And expected that sometime today the prosecution should rest and then the defense will take over its case.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much. Scott Hardy from the WTAD Newsroom. Stick around on the News Roundtable. We're going to welcome Eric Wilson, principal of health insurance firm Wilson & Associates, to the roundtable. We're going to be discussing what the Republicans are doing for repeal and replace. I'm putting those in quotes. For the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and this is kind of being redefined this week. We'll talk with Eric Wilson about that next on the News Roundtable.
WTAD.
We just took five. Dave Brubeck.
I see what you did there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the News Roundtable. on AM 930 WTAD. We now welcome to the show Eric Wilson, principal of health insurance firm Wilson & Associates. We booked Eric on the, you know, out in front of the Republicans bringing forth their version or what they want to do with the Affordable Care Act. And I want to kind of set the table here, Eric. Let's go back to pre-Obamacare. People were complaining costs were too high. The government was saying the costs were too high. They did have insurance coverage for the most part, what they could afford. Everybody obviously would always like more. Government comes along, promises coverage for everybody. And the whole, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. If you like your plan, you can keep your plan. We now know that that was a lot of hooey, except for maybe those who were exempted. And I think we forget there were a lot of groups that were initially exempted from this. Now, costs have now gone way up. Coverage essentially is less. Premiums, deductibles, way up. More and more people can't afford it and are being kicked fully into the arms of government health care. Does this plan that the Republicans have rolled out, or at least phase one, as we're hearing that now that there's going to be multiple phases of this, does this deliver us from government, or is this just more of the same?
Well, you know, I guess there's some goods, there's some bads, there's some ugly in there. I mean, they keep saying there's going to be more companies involved, which is good. And if they allow them to design, get rid of some of the mandates, you know, like every plan has a maternity and, you know, the cost of side of things, that will help it. It might drive a few companies back. But, you know, phase one doesn't seem like it achieves the objective so far, at least. Now they talk about you know companies are buying policies across state lines and whatnot coming out in phase two, so maybe. But you know, right now there's no more, you know, they didn't do anything to create more competition as far as I can tell. And also, you know, there's no individual mandate per se, but they said if you don't buy insurance now, you'll be subject to a 30% surcharge when you get sick. Well, that's worth doing as well. If I can buy insurance once I get sick, we still have the same problem.
Right. You're still, yeah, the cost angle of it is still in play. And while it may not be a penalty straight away, you know, year to year, it'll be kicked in when all of a sudden you decide you're sick and you want to buy it after the fact. That doesn't make any insurance sense. And financially, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, we know that Obamacare was financially broken. It wasn't going to be able to last. Does this just hurry up the process of this system being broken?
As far as I know, it's a band-aid on a bullet hole. I mean, really. I mean, it's like, yeah, we've created some more competition. We think we've taken a step to reduce prices, because what they're going to do is, you know, if you get rid of the maternity coverage of every plan and all the preventative care and everything out there, yeah, you can cut the cost. Sure. And if you can design your own plans the way you want, you can have good plans, Mickey Mouse plans, or some, you know, there's some stripped down plans out there you could buy. So that part adjusts costs. But then you start looking at coverage and it's like, okay, so the one problem that we had, you know, pre Affordable Care Act is there were a lot of plans out there, and they're still out there, called mini meds or scheduled benefit plans. And those plans have a place. Don't get me wrong. Unfortunately, people buy them because they're cheap. And a lot of times there's not enough coverage at the time of claim. So people have to understand what they're buying. And, you know, again, they were great for young people. There's a place for them throughout. But they're not for everybody. But unfortunately, simply we create a system now that you're going to be able to buy the cheapest thing on the market, and the cheapest thing on the market might not be worth anything.
Yeah. Are we incapable? I mean, do we absolutely positively have to have government involved here, or can we not be left to our own devices anymore?
You know, there's a very simple fix to this here, and I hope there's politicians are listening right now. All you got to do is repeal Obamacare and extend HIPAA to the individual market. Because, you know, pre-Obamacare, if you had a corporate job and you had continuous coverage for 18 months and then you changed jobs, HIPAA, you know, prohibited you from having any exclusions or denying. That did not extend to the individual market. So the reason, in my opinion, that we had pre-existing condition was because of the way they wrote HIPAA. Well, extend HIPAA to the individual market, and there's no, then the only people that have pre-existing conditions are the people who chose to game the system and not buy insurance. You know, and that's why we those people are the ones that, you know, they need to buy insurance. You know, get smart, buy insurance, or go to a risk pool and pay more.
Our guest this morning,
simple fix.
Our guest this morning on the news roundtable is Eric Wilson from Wilson and Associates, talking about what the Republicans have kind of rolled out politically. At the end of the day, right now, they kind of have the, if you'll allow me to borrow from Diary of a Wimpy Kid, they got the cheese touch on them. All of a sudden,
yeah.
when it comes to this, and this was something that they didn't want to have anything to do with 8 years ago, and now all of a sudden they're like, look, we can improve upon it, and I don't see the repeal. I see a little bit of the replace, and the phase part of it just kind of seems to be kind of, stay tuned. We can do better down the road, but is there any time frame for other phases?
Well, I mean, another meeting this week, they wanted to have the thing done by the middle of April. But, you know, I mean, I get the fact that they have to use budget reconciliation because they're not going to get 60 votes. I mean,
right.
I get that. So some of the stuff they attacked here in this 123 pages was all on, you know, on budget stuff, on the, you know, the financial side of things that they could tear apart, you know. And maybe those things tear apart enough to for the law to repeal itself. But, I mean, it just didn't make any sense. I mean, to me, I read the thing, I'm studying the thing, I'm like, where are we going with this thing? What, you know, I mean, Tom Price, you know, who's now HHS director, had a nice plan that was written, you know, back, I think, in 2011,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a replacement there. And it's still the best plan I've seen. And now he's HHS secretary, and we're still not getting it. I mean, step up here, guys. Let's read Dr. Price's bill, and let's get it out there.
Yeah, everybody kind of felt comforted by the fact that Price got put into that position. And knowing his past, that this would kind of funnel into that. And you're right, it kind of seems like that's been ignored, at least for the time being. Now, other people are saying, well, this is just the beginning of a negotiation. Is it really a good beginning? I mean, there's a lot of room to be moved in a more sensible direction, isn't there?
Well, I mean, I guess you got to put something on the table. That, you know, my opinion, and I really can't back this up with except for opinion, is that they left some stuff in there to try to get some Democrat support, you know, the pre-existing condition stuff and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I call it mini Obamacare, or a mini version of it. There, try to get some of the big supporters of Obamacare on board. It sounds like they're still not on board with it, however. But I mean, yeah, I am sure that it won't look anything like it does now when it's finished. I mean, I guess you have to put something on the table to actually start negotiations. So, I guess you have to do something, but. I think I would have gone a little bit more hardcore than this.
One of the things that I think I've heard some concern about over the last 36 hours or so is that if Obamacare isn't completely dismantled, if the structure isn't completely destroyed, if and or when Democrats regain control in Washington, D.C., they're just going to build onto it, kind of like the Frankenstein monster will still be there, and they'll just need to juice the electricity to it to get it up and moving and have it start coming after us.
Right. You're absolutely correct there. I mean, they got to gut this thing entirely because if they've said, if they do nothing, by next year there'll be no more Obamacare because, you know, no one can afford it now. The people who are unsubsidized can't afford it now. Rates have doubled, fewer doctors, fewer hospitals, fewer everything accepting it. So it could fail on its own. So they have to fix it. But I mean, let's fix it.
Right.
I mean, let's not dance around the issue here.
Are the voters in a kind of a hold pattern to wait and see, or should they be active in contacting their representatives?
I would be active. I mean, I would say this bill is not very good, and let's get this, and let's hammer this thing out and be right. Get it right the first time.
Yeah, getting it right the first time. We appreciate.
I mean, we've been wrong now for 8 years. I mean, you know, here's the other the biggest problem. I think, you know, I think this is what people don't realize. Since the majority of the people, you know, get their coverage through their jobs, you know, employer sponsored health care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a fairly small population of that are, you know, self employed or the independent contractor or the small businessman that need insurance. Right? And of that, it's another smaller population of those that are quote unquote uninsurable. You know, pre-Obamacare, and I wrote one of the first blogs I ever wrote, and it was actually a horribly written blog back in, I think, 2009, back when I was young and stupid. But I wrote a blog about the uninsurables, and they kept saying there was 52 million uninsured Americans. But when you grilled into the information, you know, a lot of the people that were uninsured, they weren't uninsurable, they were just uninsured by choice, whether it be between jobs or they made $100,000 a year and didn't feel the need to purchase insurance. And the number of uninsurables was close to 10 million, okay, of uninsurable. Okay, and that's still a high number of uninsured, and probably too many. But if we focus on the 10 million who are uninsurable, that's a whole lot different than trying to insure 50 million. You know, two separate conversations.
Right.
So figure out how to insure the 10 million that are uninsurable with continuing, extending HIPAA or risk pool, or, you know, let the states decide. You know, the state of Ohio had a great way of doing it. Follow what's worked in other states and figure out the 10 million. But let's not worry about 50 million, because if someone chooses not to purchase insurance, I guess that's the prerogative.
All right. Eric Wilson.
Sorry, I wouldn't do it, but, you know, that's the prerogative, I guess.
All right. We're running out of time. Eric Wilson, principal of health insurance firm Wilson & Associates, thank you for being on the News Roundtable this morning. We'd like to have you back again to talk about this as it moves forward.
Love to come.
All right. That's the News Roundtable this morning. Join us again tomorrow, 10 a.m. on AM 930 WTAD.
The News Roundtable will reconvene tomorrow morning at 10:06 a.m. on AM 930 WTAD. Podcast available online at WTAD.com.